Hello, listeners.
Oh my gosh, am I ever going to have this baby?
I am so sick of being pregnant.
Thank God I did not ever go long time.
My first baby was 42 weeks.
Oh, no, I'm 35, 36, and 37.
My second baby was 37 and 6. Somewhere in between there, being pregnant is no longer cute and fun.
Today we're going to be talking about late term and post term babies. And just to give you a good picture before we start, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development defines late term as 41 and 0 days to 41 and 6 days. And then post term is 42 and 0 days to everything. Oh my God, you've been pregnant for half your life.
Common medical terminology for late term, 288 days to 294 days post-ovulation.
That's so long.
For late term. For post-term, anything greater than 295 days post-ovulation.
Y'all think about 295 days. What
but you're
you
not.
Do in 295 days?
Whole keeper.
Like a horse.
Oh, it's so long.
Or an elephant. It's so long.
An elephant. Sure.
Now think about those moms of premature babies who just barely got a baby bump and they never really got to feel pregnant.
Right. And then these late-term, post-term moms who feel like I haven't seen my feet in so long, I don't remember what they look like.
There's a happy medium in there somewhere.
Right. It's called term.
It's called 39 weeks and 0 days. That's the little cute medium.
I don't know. I personally would say 37 was super happy. As we are starting this series to talk about gestational age, I just want to really quick kind of mention, you see our population kind of divided into two categories. One of them, people talk about birth weight, and the other one, we talk about gestation. And, you know, we'll mention this again as we talk about other categories of term and gestational age at delivery. But it's important to understand that there are physiological implications that go with gestation and development and, you know, how the placenta is functioning and how mom is handling things and what is going on with the baby. And some of those things really get lost when you talk about birth weight. Yes, there are certain things that go with being small for gestation, like SGA, or being large for gestation, LGA, but really a lot of the risks that are involved come down more to the physiology of a fetus at a particular point in development, and also the physiology and function of moms at that same point in development. You know, the placenta at 42 weeks does not function the same as it does at 32 weeks. It's a different thing. And there are structures in babies at 24 weeks that by the time you get to this late term, post term, they aren't there anymore. They've gone away. And so, you know, when we talk about this with you guys, what we are going to talk about is gestational age and the physiology and the function. And then, like I said, you know, we'll kind of mention as we go along the birth weight piece, but definitely, you know, in my opinion anyway, as a nurse developing a practice, it's important to understand the age piece more than the weight part. Do you guys agree with that?
I think so too, because your weight can vary so much. You've got a gestational diabetic mom, that baby might be huge at 30 weeks. You've got a teeny tiny little anorexic mom, that baby may be teeny tiny at birth.
You have a mom who has mild to moderate preeclampsia. You may have a baby that's intrauterine growth restricted. And intrauterine growth restricted is defined as any baby who falls below the 3rd percentile or the 3rd percentile on the growth chart. And we're using these initialisms like LGA, AGA, SGA. What they stand for, LGA is large for gestational age. Every hospital seems to use a different growth chart. AGA is average for gestational age. Anything greater than the 10th percentile, lower than the 90th percentile is going to be AGA. Your SGA babies are less than your 10th percentile. So 4% to 10th percentile is SGA. Lower than the 3rd percentile is intrauterine growth restricted. It's an important piece of the picture. I agree with Rebecca. We need to consider the gestational age when we are throwing interventions at babies.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you don't, a term kid that's 1,000 grams is not going to need the same interventions as a 30 liter that's 1,000 grams.
Right.
They're
right.
Totally different beings. And you'll find as you guys start practicing, your hospital, I feel like they draw a line. They either do one or the other.
Right.
They typically don't vacillate between the two. They either go the gestational age route or they go the birth weight route.
So that comes from a lot of sort of the Vermont Oxford standard weight distinction kind of made its way into practice because that was what this database was looking at. And I know for myself, in my own practice, you know, my heart belongs to the little ones. And so it was interesting to me as I was growing my practice to look at this line that was drawn over birth weight and then to kind of realize that, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm slide too. Because like you said, you know, 1,000 gram 32 weeker is very, very different from 1,000 gram 28 weeker.
I love sharing stories. I love it. So again, having come from maternity back into high acuity NICU, I feel like my goal is to merge the two into everyone's practice across the board. A nurse that I was working with was feeding a 39-week gestation baby who weighed 1,900 grams, I want to say. This was a small full-term baby. And she was feeding this baby with a slow flow nipple. And this baby was biting, thrusting this thing out of his mouth, annoyed, did not eat very much. I want to say he maybe took 10 cc's. She got busy with something, asked me to feed the baby. I had noticed on his crib card, which gives us information, that he was technically close to term. And I called newborn nursery and got a newborn nipple for this baby. And he ate 45 cc's for me in minutes.
And so I think that's where it goes into you need to look more at your gestational age versus your birth weight.
Right.
And where sometimes when you consider your birth weight to hold higher value than your gestational age, you end up basically mistreating some of these babies.
Right.
So mm-hmm. When we're diving in today, we're diving into these post-term, term, late-term babies. So what do you see when a baby's born at 42 weeks?
Yeah.
What does that baby look like?
You have all the wrong side.
So these babies in the labor process, having been a labor nurse, when a mom comes in and she is 42 weeks, her water is not ruptured. Like we don't have rupture membranes yet. The minute I hear 42 weeks, I think to myself, okay, we really need to get a good fetal monitoring strip on this baby. What I talk to that mom about is at 42 weeks, we as a team start to get really concerned about placental perfusion. Post dates, the placenta, it starts to calcify. It looks like it is white specks on this placenta. It looks marbled. It is dark. It is a dark organ at this point. It's not that nice, beefy, red, healthy placenta. Marbled with it's calcified. It looks white. The baby then is not getting the perfusion that they need. And so when moms come in and they're 42 weeks, I talk to that mom about, I would really like to get a good fetal monitoring strip on you, on your baby, so that we can have an idea as to how well your baby's tolerating labor.
Right.
The other thing I do, maybe even before that conversation happens, when I see that this mom is in triage, I will go ahead and I will set up a laryngoscope and I will set up my intubation supplies.
Why?
Because at 42 weeks with decreased placental perfusion, this baby is going to be stressed out. And we are at risk for meconium aspiration syndrome.
Absolutely.
And we don't know that there's meconium until the water breaks. And once you have rupture of membranes, if you're 10 centimeters and that baby's about to deliver, I don't want to be behind that eight ball.
You know, I got to tell you, not having the mom experience as a NICU nurse, when they tell me that they're bringing me a 42-weeker, oh, it makes me want to vomit. Because I feel like, you know, when you come in 24 weeks, I have a good idea of what I'm going to see and how I'm going to treat it. But those late-term, post-term babies, man, I feel like they scare me. Yes. You know what I mean? Oh. Like there's so much that can go into that.
Meconium aspiration, I think, is really scary for the NICU team because you never know how that baby's going to come out.
Right. Some of those meconium babies are fine.
They're totally fine. Other babies end up cooling on ECMO.
Right.
I mean, you just never know. And so immediately when I see 42 weeks, I think to myself, I want to be prepared for this delivery. And I've had nurse practitioners just get a little irritated with me, but I am not going to take that risk. I want these steps of resuscitation done as soon as that baby comes out. You know, if mom is refusing rupture of membranes at 42 weeks, I'm here to tell you I want that provider at the delivery.
Right. I'm with Rebecca. You know, I see a 24-weeker on the board. I know what I'm going to do for that 24-weeker. I see a 42-weeker on the board. I'm like, so meconium aspiration. We're going to get stuck.
TTN, shoulder dystocia.
Or are we going to be fine?
Yes. Are we going to be fine and go right to skin to skin with mom? The gamut is so wide. But, you know, you're 24-weeker. Nope, we're going to put you right up here. Here, mom, get your picture. Now we go. Right. Mm-hmm. Off to the NICU. But your 42-weekers, there's so much unknown that you just got to wait.
Right.
So I do also think, you know, we were talking really quick before about gestation versus weight. And I think that one of the reasons why that line was drawn initially, because this was my thought when you're saying, when I see 42 weeks, and some of them are fine, is y'all, I hate to say it, but not every baby mama tells the truth about when that baby was made.
True statement.
Right. We cannot always categorically say this baby was created on this date. And every now and again, we do have moms who will kind of fudge the story a little bit. So it is, I think, to me, especially nerve-wracking, you know, with these kids, because when these kids are bad, they're really bad. Right. So when you have meconium aspiration, when you have some of these like placental insufficiency that's now made this drama, these are like big problems that we are struggling with. And we don't know. Like that baby could have really been like 36 weeks in the neighbor's kid and we don't talk about it.
And there's a gamut there, but.
I mean, there's measurements that can be done.
Right.
You know, that indicate whether, you know, that indicate that gestational age. I think the big point is that when a baby is late term or post term, we just don't know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We have no idea what's going to happen.
And when that baby comes out, what does that baby look like?
Well, let's talk about a little bit, and we will talk about what this baby looks like, what a 42-week gestation baby looks like. What I think we miss a lot of times are the risk factors of the post-term delivery, waiting 42 weeks puts this baby at a greater risk for meconium aspiration, puts this baby at greater risk for shoulder dystocia, operative delivery being either a vacuum or forceps or cesarean. This baby might get stuck. And I know for sure I've been in situations where mom is laboring and you're checking that cervix and that head starts to engage. And I've thought to myself, I just don't know that this baby's going to fit
right through
this pelvic outlet. Like this just doesn't, like this baby's going to be too big. And really having that good communication with the provider and allowing that provider to guide the family in a decision on how to proceed. The risk to mom is postpartum hemorrhage. There's risk factors with operative delivery for mom. You know, you have a high rate of extensive tearing for mom with your late and post-term babies, you know, the baby, if the baby does end up being born vaginally, you're talking maybe like a third or fourth degree tear. Mm. And that, I mean, nobody really wants to experience that. And I know that there's unknowns for the mom when it comes to cesarean delivery. You know, I think a lot of times as NICU nurses, we kind of disregard the risk to the mom as well. You know, and really medically, we need to walk a line between what's best for baby, what's best for mom.
Right. So maybe this is a dumb question, but why is your postpartum hemorrhage risk more for these moms?
Because the babies tend to be larger. So the larger,
it's more related to the actual delivery than it is like...
Yeah, uterine atony after the delivery. So you've got this really big baby and this muscle that needs to like shrink back down and really constrict around the vessels that were feeding the placenta. And so you've stretched this muscle out.
Oh.
Right. So you've stretched this muscle out. Now the baby's come out. Now this muscle needs to contract down again.
Right.
And sometimes that muscle's so stretched out that it has a hard time contracting down on those vessels
right.
that were feeding the placenta.
So I have to say, I mean, you said NICU nurses don't always do a great job of thinking of mom, and 100, yes, you are absolutely correct. And I super, super love that your strength always is teaching. I feel like you're always teaching me, not just in NICU, because you do always teach me in NICU, but like that piece, because I don't know that it's necessarily that NICU nurses don't care. I think that we're not exposed.
It's a lack of awareness.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't, not every facility sends all of their nurses to deliveries. You know, I've been a NICU nurse for 15 years and I think I've seen 4 deliveries. 2 of them were my own. Right. So it's just not something that every NICU nurse gets. And it's interesting to me, especially to hear like, you put those pieces together. I super love that. Anyway.
So if I have a postterm baby, I'm at high risk for subsequent pregnancies going postterm.
Not necessarily. Usually it's that first pregnancy that goes postterm. Your subsequent pregnancies tend to not be as long.
Right. And a prima gravida has their own set of worries as well. Like, don't they tend to labor longer? And
sometimes, yep. I mean, that is the trend that we would generally see in labor and delivery is that first time mom, she gets a little bit longer to labor.
Right.
This is her first time. That baby, her body hasn't done this before. We need to give them time.
You talk some about mom's risk, you know, and we kind of glanced or breezed over like the baby part of it. Can you talk a little bit about the labor itself? Like, how do these babies handle it? How does this mom handle it? Does it matter that I've been pregnant for so long that I could have done all these other things? Like, physically for your body, does it change that process any?
I don't think it doesn't change the process any. You know, a mom can come in laboring at 36 weeks, the same as she can come in laboring at 42 weeks. We're a little bit more aware of the risk of that the lack of placental perfusion in that 42-week gestation. We're a little bit more aware that this baby could be large. We really, for the mom, the process really doesn't change. If mom comes in at 42 weeks and she's not laboring, then that process is medically induced.
So according to...
Hold on. I should say that process, it is recommended that process be induced. We really, this generation of moms is not a generation that comes in and says, I'll do whatever my provider says.
That's true. I think we kind of mentioned that in our last episode.
And I think that that's going to be the trend through our episodes is you have a population of parents right now that have access to everything. There's so much information out there on the internet that families look at and consider. You know, even my oldest child was 42 weeks. I didn't go on to Google and look at the pros and cons of being induced versus not induced She was a scheduled cesarean for the day after she ended up being born. And I kept saying, let's wait and see what happens. Let's just wait and see what happens. My mom had vaginal deliveries. My aunts all had vaginal deliveries. There's no reason to think that this baby won't come out vaginally. My concern was the risk of infection for a C-section. It's major abdominal surgery. The risk of having my baby in the NICU after a cesarean. Those were my concerns. And if I could prevent those risk factors, I was kind of like, let's just hang out and see what happens.
Right.
So the night before she was scheduled for a cesarean, my water broke. I went into labor and, you know, I went into the hospital and they said, well, we can do the C-section now. And I said, well, let's wait and see what happens.
Right.
If my cervix doesn't dilate by this time, whatever time it was in the morning. And I said, if we haven't made any progress by noon,
right,
then let's go ahead and talk about this option. And she was born by noon.
Right.
And so, you know, I think what you have with this generation is just like they're informed. And it may be misinformation, it may be good information, but really these are families that are making their own decisions.
Right.
Along with the provider.
I think that is kind of the idea too of where our podcast came from, was kind of trying to make sure that nurses have access to good, real, solid, vetted, peer-reviewed information that then we can pass along, because there is just an abundance of information out there. Some of it is real. You know, the story that I read where they said that the nurse went and gave the baby a circumcision at the bedside all by herself and nobody else was present probably did not actually happen.
Right.
You know what I mean? So really quickly, in 2020, the CDC's vital statistics said that 4.88% of babies born were considered late term, and only 0.25% were post term. But that's 5% of the babies born, right? So this population is not, I feel like when I started, we didn't see a whole lot of kids that were late term, post term babies, right? And again, that's generational. You know, we were doing a lot more cesarean. They weren't letting people go as long. Right. And so now seeing this, you know, we're seeing a lot more of it.
There are a lot more inductions too. You think about it. Somebody comes in and is like, I want my baby born on January 1st because this was Great Ethel's birthday and I want my baby born on Great Ethel's birthday.
Right.
There's a lot more doctors who would buy into that, who would let you do that, because some of the risks associated with C-sections or inductions were kind of just either unknown or not recognized.
Right. And also, to be fair, I feel like in generations, like in my generation, generations before now, right, we were a lot more inclined to like trust that the doctor said, mm-hmm, I'm supposed to do this. So clearly this is what I'm supposed to do. I mean, like you said, Darla, we weren't looking up, you know, a lot of the information that was there. I know I was a gestational diabetic, insulin dependent for both of my pregnancies. And so for me, and I happen to be nerdy anyway, I was looking at maybe more of it. But when my doctor told me to do something, I was like, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, and you're right. We see parents being a little more hesitant to trust that recommendation is absolutely the end all be all.
And you see that, I see that with, I can think back to my first pregnancy, going in and one of the providers saying, well, do you have a date you want your baby born on? What?
Right.
Like, I get to choose this? I thought it just comes out when it comes out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then going into subsequent pregnancies, with my last pregnancy, it was recommended that I take a baby aspirin from the get-go to prevent me from having to use Levonox should my blood start clotting on me. But, you know, I, being the first-time mom who was like, oh, let's choose a date, to, okay, I see that you're recommending these baby aspirins, but guess what? I'm now 8 years older with 8 more years experience on me. I'm going to research why I'm taking this. And
right,
this is
right,
the best decision for me and my body. And that's where you see that changing, is this generation, and as they have more access,
right,
to information or to birthing experiences, you see them researching and going, you know what, It used to be you hit 39 weeks. You hit 40 weeks. They're talking cesarean.
Yeah.
You know, you're 40 and 1 going for that 40-week checkup to see where you are. You're scheduling your date.
Right.
And now they're giving moms more leeway to go to that 42-week and beyond.
Right. Yeah,
I know for me, I didn't have that option because I was an insulin-dependent gestational diabetic. It was, you know, it's not recommended to go even close to that.
I think 38 weeks, I think, is the recommended week of delivery for gestational diabetics.
I think when mine were born, it was more like 37, but still in that same kind of window.
It is. It's still in that same window. Again, we talk about, I guess maybe that's a whole different podcast too, talking about risk factors, but gestational diabetes is a risk factor for placental insufficiency, gestational diabetes. Infants of diabetic mothers have less surfactant than non-diabetic moms. Right. It's really fascinating. And I, again, to kind of go on my soapbox, I really, really, there needs to be a dyad approach.
Right.
And that just does not happen right now.
Mm-hmm. So with this group and this dyad, what are we looking at?
So in this group, in this dyad, we're looking at post-term, we're looking at risk of meconium aspiration. We're looking at the shoulder dystocia risk just because the babies tend to be a little larger. These babies come out, their skin's dry and peeling. Like,
you want to scrub them down.
You want to scrub
our
them
assessment.
Down.
What's our assessment?
Our
like,
assessment.
Go head to toe for us on a late-term, post-term.
Head to toe on a late-term, post-term baby. Babies tend to have less brown fat than your term babies. They have peeling skin. They're at greater risk for musculoskeletal deformities than your term babies.
Just because they run out of room?
They run out of space. That congenital hip dysplasia or hip dysplasia, these babies are at greater risk for hip dysplasia. We saw one time a newborn with a clubbed foot. I don't want to say a true clubbed foot, but the feet were kind of twisted inwards at the ankles. Baby
just space.
Just space. Baby ran out of space. So you kind of look for things like that when you're doing a head-to-toe assessment on the infant. Obviously, the hip dysplasia is something that the practitioner would see. I've seen dislocated knee joints on babies. There is a technical term for that. I cannot think of it right now. You know, basically all of those things that you would think when a baby runs out of space.
I know for me, I feel like when I'm seeing post-term babies, I'm always a little surprised. They're so big and yet they look almost wasted, like because they're peely, because they don't have that brown fat, right? Because some of those things are different.
She's addressed with the placental
insufficiency.
They aren't getting the nutrients.
They're not getting the nutrients, and they've really had to kind of burn through some of those energy stores that were meant to sustain them. You know, a normal term baby without any risk factors can really survive on a couple of drops of colostrum because they have physiological
stores
to get them through the first couple of days until mom's milk comes in. Now, these babies who have had placental insufficiency for, I don't know how long, a week maybe, and that's completely made up. I don't know how long the placental insufficiency goes. Correct. And so they come out and, you know, I've seen post-date babies that look almost gray.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like,
And I think that again is a gap in my practice when I'm not going there. It really surprised me to see.
And I think wasted is such a good way of phrasing it. They look wasted, like
emaciated almost. When you I think mentally picture these babies that we would consider shoulder dystocia risk, right? In my mind, I'm picturing like this super fat little like cherub baby, and what I actually saw the first time, I was like, it truly was shocking to me, and wasted was the only thing I could think of, because he was big, right? But he wasn't like fat big. He was just big.
And we don't do, so babies that are large for gestational age are set up for hypoglycemia, we don't do blood sugar checks on babies just because they are LGA, or just because we do not do blood sugars on babies just because they are post-term.
Got it.
If these babies are post-term and LGA, then we do blood sugar checks.
That makes sense. You don't do blood sugar checks with the ones that look wasted.
No.
Malnourished.
Mm-mm. No.
So what if a baby comes out post-term and they're that malnourished looking, almost failure to thrive? That's the word I'm looking for. Type baby. Do you immediately look at supplementing with some IV fluids? Do you just try to feed, move on?
Just try to feed and move on. If baby shows signs of hypoglycemia, we will check a blood sugar. It's typically all of the places that I've worked, it has been in the standard newborn order set that if the baby presents with signs of hypoglycemia, the jittery, lethargy signs, to go ahead and get a blood sugar, but not as a standard. These babies do come out. I don't have statistics on it. Most of the time, what I have seen is these post-term babies are LGA, and we end up doing blood sugars on them.
Just curiosity and thinking through the malnourished piece of it and not undernourishment from the placenta, like long-term, which if they don't go to the NICU, you don't see it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it makes you just think, okay, so when you go for that 1 month, 3 month checkup with your pediatrician, where are you on the growth curve? Like, are you, you know?
I'm curious to know that as well.
I'll see if I can find some numbers on it. There's a girl over here.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about assessment on these kids that shocked me was the nails.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the nails. You know, we talk about Dubowitz for gestational age scoring, and I'm sure we can do a whole episode on that at some point. But when you talk about Dubowitz, you know, it's more about sort of physical characteristics, muscle characteristics. But, man, those nails on these late-term, post-term babies. Across the room, you see them in the bed and you were like, how long did you cook? Right?
Where's a file?
Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the hair, like length of the hair,
right,
on their head, you're like, are we tolerating?
Right. Can we put a ponytail in that?
And the peel of skin.
Right.
So since, you know, we're NICU specific and the dyad is important, but I only have to manage the baby part of that dyad.
Right.
Later, right. When these kids are now coming to the NICU, what are we looking at? So post resuscitation, what do we see?
Usually respiratory distress.
Got it. Because of meconium specifically, or because of that insufficiency for too long?
So these babies are also at risk for oligohydramnios. Right. And so when those fluid pockets are low, you're set up for respiratory distress syndrome. And so that lack of surfactant caused by that lack of fluid, the deactivation of surfactant by the meconium, what we will typically see with post-term babies is respiratory distress.
Got it.
Not to be confused with transient tachypnea of the newborn.
Right.
This is respiratory distress. And so they will require some sort of oxygen. And these babies require a different kind of developmental care.
Sure.
These babies come out, they want to be held. They want to eat. Once they get up enough reserve from the respiratory support that we're giving them, they are typically angry. They're trying to eat their hands. They're trying to eat their oxygen equipment. They might be sucking on their endotracheal tube. What I will have moms do for these babies, specifically any baby that is full term to post term, when she pumps, if this baby is still not eating, I will take that colostrum. I will either swab the baby's mouth with it, or I will put it on a washcloth, and I will put that washcloth over the baby's face so that they can smell that colostrum.
Right.
The baby recognizes the smell of mom through that colostrum. And I have noticed in my practice that babies are calm when they can smell that colostrum.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about that piece of it, I feel like, I mean, again, like NICU nurses, you know, we said when you come in at 24 weeks, I know what I'm looking at. I feel like when a mom delivers at 24 weeks, she's anticipating a NICU stay. How are these parents? When you tell them you wanted this perfect granola, like you said, like delivery and everything is just right. And now because you waited so long, we're headed to the NICU.
I think when we say, like, because you waited so long, I feel like that kind of puts the NICU stay on the parents.
Right, which you're right, and I apologize. I didn't.
No. I just think that it's important, and it's a segue into supporting these parents.
Right.
We have to be careful about what we say. Parents are, I mean, they're sensitive. These are their babies. And so, you know, they wanted to wait. Yes. Would this baby have potentially ended up in the NICU for the same reason 2 weeks prior? Maybe. We don't know. We really don't. We have no idea. It really takes a lot of emotional support. And really, these parents were expecting a healthy full-term baby to come out and stay in the room with them. And I always explain to parents, the baby needs to be in the NICU. The last thing that we want to do is separate families and babies.
Right.
And moms blame themselves for everything.
All the time.
And I cannot tell you how many times I have told moms, this is not your fault.
And I think when I say waited so long, that piece was kind of part of what I was thinking, because I know for myself, I see a lot of maternal guilt and also, you know, some real mourning and regret, because I thought I was making all the right choices for my baby. And here we are.
And that's it. And that's the big part of that support. And it's true. When you have a baby that comes in that's 23, 24, 25 weeks, families have already mentally sort of prepared themselves for a NICU stay.
Right. And a lot of them have had consults even with neonatology. You know, the physicians or practitioners have gone in and had a conversation.
Their obstetric team has prepared them
right.
a little bit. This is what could happen. This is what we anticipate. So the families anticipate that as well. For a term baby, post-term baby, we don't even talk about the NICU for these babies. And so when they come out and they have to have that NICU stay, it is devastating.
Right.
And I'm not saying that a 24-weeker isn't devastating. This is devastating in another way.
Right. It's different. You are mourning that loss of not having that baby. You have completely set yourself up to deliver a baby, put it skin to skin, snuggle, breastfeed, do whatever you want to do postpartum, where, you know, depending on how that 42-week or that postterm baby comes out, you know, you may get a picture. You may get that baby weighed in the delivery room, or if that baby is in severe respiratory distress, you're going to get a quick, okay, we're taking your baby to the NICU. We'll let you know what's happening.
Right.
And that is not, you're no way prepared for that.
I recently had a baby that was cooling. It was over a year ago when I say recent. And the mom came over, and it was the first time that she was at the bedside. And I'm running through all of the things, like your baby's on cooling, your baby's on an EEG monitor, your baby's getting nutrition through an IV. We have your baby sedated with these medications. This is what's happening. This is the typical course. This is when we rewarm, blah, 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 going through all of the things that I thought were important. And she looked at me and she said, when can I breastfeed my baby?
Because that was the thing that she had in her mind. That was that, like, focus.
And that was the focus.
Yeah.
And we are taking a sense of normal away from these
right.
parents.
And I do also think that there's a piece on the nursing side, you know, to us, it is so obvious that you can't breastfeed this baby right now. Why are you even asking me that question? And I think that sometimes we forget that, I mean, you do have this whole experience that you have lived over and over and over and over and over in your head. And then it's gone. I know in my own practice, one of the things that I say to all of my parents at some point is, it is okay for you to be angry and afraid and to mourn the loss of the experience that you planned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And not only is it okay, it's important, because you have to be able to move forward. And sometimes you can't move forward until you've, like, mourned that piece of it, you know?
Yes.
And we'll talk about all the rest of it another day.
Another day.
Another day.
Another day.
See, we keep mentioning the other day, another day, because we want you to come back.
We want
Absolutely.
You to come back.
We hope that you hang out with us. The next time we talk, we're going to talk about term babies and kind of what that looks like.
How about early term and full term?
Okay. So we're going to talk about that and what goes with those babies. And again, just like we did with this set, kind of what you're seeing on assessment, what risks there are, what the dyad looks at.
Ooh, and I love the dyad.
I know, and I love that you love it, and I feel like our practice grows because of it all the time. Join us next time for late term and term. Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're going to be talking about.
All right.
What do you think, Michelle?
Early term.
Ooh.
Oh, you're right. I said it backwards. Thank you.
Because we talked about the late ones coming to the party.
Thank you. So
I feel like the late ones kind of terrify the two of you a little bit.
A lot.
A whole lot.
I'm going to be real honest.
Oh, wow.
I see anything over about 40 and 5, and I'm like, okay, what kind of roller coaster ride are we going on today?
You come on and get me.
Yeah, absolutely. I do. What are you talking about?
Right.
All right. So we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for hanging out with us.